I've done this practice for some dear ones when they departed, and over the course of the 49 days I did feel that some powerful purification was taking place, even if what was being purified was my own grief. One of those dear ones was my first wife, Maggie. She became something of a Buddhist teacher in her own right, and Vajrasattva practice was her specialty. She used to teach it at retreats for the lamas she assisted, and she loved practicing it. That surprised me, because she generally didn't care much for chanting or anything that smacked of ritual. "With Vajrasattva, I feel like I'm accomplishing something," she explained. "I'm getting things clean." Well, she loved doing laundry, too, so that made sense. A few days after Maggie died, one of her students found a cassette tape of her explaining and leading the practice, including the instructions for using it after someone's death. We played it at her funeral, so that she wound up leading us in doing the practice to facilitate her own clear passage. We sprang it on the group without any introduction, but it opened with her saying, "Okay, we're really going to have some fun," followed by her deep, uninhibited laugh, and everyone knew right away who it was. Chapter 16. Working In. In the prisons where I've taught, most of the guys work out. They may do push-ups and chin-ups and especially lift weights every chance they get. Of course, they're trying to stay fit and vital despite the pasty food and long hours of inactivity. But they're also packing on layers of armor, making their bodies formidable so that, even if they have no desire to mess with anyone, no one will mess with them. Under the circumstances, that's a perfectly sensible strategy. It's one way of using the body to find a more relaxed, fearless way of being. Still, covering your fear with armor is not the same thing as discovering the space beyond fear and then living from that space. That's our project, and there are skillful ways to enlist the body to help accomplish it. Working out is fine. We're going to work in. There are elaborate traditional systems of working in, such as yoga and tai chi, but not everyone will have the time and motivation to find an outstanding yoga or tai chi teacher, take classes, and follow up with a full routine. So it's good to have something you can do in just a few minutes a day, on your own, no matter where you are. That way, you'll keep working in from the outside, making the body more pliable, confident, and tuned in to the place of frictionless freedom, which you're finding from the inside through meditation. And if you also like to lift weights or do kickboxing or bungee jumping or anything else, that's fine too. It's all good. The following 6 moves are about as natural and intuitive as the stretching a dog or cat does when it gets up from a nap. Versions of them are found in Asian martial arts and yoga, but let's speak American and give them names we can remember. Twisting, rolling, bumping and grinding, closing, turning, opening. As with tying your shoelaces, it takes a lot of words to describe the whole sequence, but after you've done it a few times, you'll see how simple it is. And on the Fearless page of my website, deanwords.com, you'll find photos illustrating the moves. Important: don't strain. Never try to force your body into any position. Breathe normally and move slowly as you come out of one position and go into the next. Twisting. Stand with your feet slightly more than shoulder width apart, your arms loose at your sides. Keeping your arms and shoulders very loose and relaxed, twist your hips and lower abdomen to the left, then to the right. Your relaxed arms will flop along, trailing a moment or two behind. Keep twisting left and right, initiating the movement in the hips and lower abs, not the upper body. As you pick up a little speed, twist as far to each side as you comfortably can, and pause there for half a beat, letting your floppy, loosey-goosey arms swing around you a moment later. As you twist to the left, Your right hand should swing around in front of you and then gently slap your lower back on the left side, while your left hand swings around behind you to gently slap your lower back on the right. Then vice versa as you twist to the right. Go back and forth like this for a while. Physically, this is a quick, do-it-anywhere way to loosen up the whole body. The gentle slapping of your lower back stimulates the kidneys and adrenals, a natural way to get energized before diving into the day's activities. But you're also reprogramming yourself out of the habit of trying to muscle your way through your challenges with your upper body and limbs, carrying your burdens on your shoulders, taking arms against a sea of troubles, elbowing people out of your way, taking the situation in hand. Instead, you're using the greater, untapped power that comes, literally, from deeper down. In my Aikido days, I would often find myself straining unsuccessfully to throw my practice partner by using upper body strength. My teacher would come up behind me, gently lay his hands on my shoulders, and say, "Drop your energy to your center." I would relax my shoulders and do the move again, this time from the abdomen and hips, and my partner would go flying across the mat. This exercise can help you engage your daily challenges in the same way I learned to engage my partner. When a challenge arises, pay attention and see if you feel tension rising in your shoulders. Then, just as if the teacher's hands are on them, consciously let the tension go and drop your energy to the abdomen and hips, with a sense of initiating your response from that deeper, stronger, less stress-prone place. Rolling. Lie down on your back, preferably on a carpet, folded blanket, or yoga mat. Pull your knees up to your chest, or as close to your chest as they'll comfortably go. Roll over onto your left side. Push off with the left elbow and roll onto the right side. Then push off with the right elbow and roll back onto the left. Continue to roll back and forth a few more times. Your head can either be raised or remain on the floor, whichever is more comfortable. This rolling has a wonderful loosening, softening effect on the whole body. Some people say it makes them feel like a tough steak being tenderized. And, because of the connection between outer and inner, it loosens up and tenderizes your attitude as well. When you're doing something so childlike and playful, it's hard to take your sad, grown-up stories very seriously. It always makes me think of Terry Garr as goofy, sexy Inga in Young Frankenstein. "Would you like to have a roll in the hay? It's fun. Roll, roll, roll in the hay. Roll, roll, roll in the hay." Bumping and grinding. Get on all fours, with your hands directly beneath your shoulders, fingers pointing forward, and your arms and thighs squared off beneath you, perpendicular to the floor. Keep them that way throughout this move. Now, round your back toward the ceiling while dropping your head toward the floor and bumping your pelvis forward toward your head. Next, do the opposite. Let your back sag, arching toward the floor as your head comes up and your pelvis tilts back. Go back and forth a few times between rounding and sagging, then rest in the original squared-off position. Next, still keeping the arms and thighs perpendicular to the floor, move your pelvis round and round in a circular grinding motion. Make the circles nice and big and feel the movement all the way up your spine. Do several circles in one direction, then in the other. Bumping and grinding quickly loosen the entire back and particularly free up the booty. One of our language's most insightful mind-body puns is tight-assed. Not surprisingly, people often store tension, fear, and inhibition in the areas of the buttocks and crotch, including sexual inhibition, or its flip side, sexual aggression. But thousands of years before Freud, the ancient yogis understood that the powerful energies we think of as sexual are deeply connected to powerful energies that play out in all areas of our lives. In another edifying pun, our seat is the seat of forces that we may understand only dimly, yet which can drive our actions with an almost irresistible force. These moves help make the flow of those energies smooth and relaxed, and give you a chance to have a friendly, easygoing, playful relationship with them. What shall we do today, pelvic energy? Make a baby? Build a house? Write a novel? Let's work together. Closing. From the previous position, keep your hands and knees where they are, and simply sit back on your heels, or as close to them as you can, with your forehead on the floor. Again, never strain. Continue to rest in this position. If you prefer, bring your arms back till they're alongside your legs, palms up. Then fully release your arms, elbows, and shoulders, surrendering them to gravity. For some people, especially large men with lots of muscle mass, this position will be easier if, as you sit back, you place a cushion between your calves and your thighs. In the final position, close your eyes and relax. Feel all the muscles of your back stretching and letting go, along both the vertical and horizontal axes simultaneously, as gravity pulls them toward the floor. Emotionally, you're now closed within yourself, cozy, sheltered from all storms. Your heart is tucked away, hidden, protected, like a not-yet-germinated seed within its husk. You're safe. Stay like this for as long as you like. Don't count the seconds, and don't be mentally moving on to the next activity. For now, be here, safe, timeless. Turning. Return to the original all fours position, with the arms and legs perpendicular to the ground. Bring both arms straight out in front of you, palms down, fingers forward. Then, extend your left arm under your right armpit, palm up, sliding it along the floor as far as you comfortably can. At the same time, turn your head to the right and rest the left side of your head on the floor. Close your eyes and feel the turning, torquing force that this position exerts, all the way from your hips to the base of your skull. There's something delicious about this. It almost hurts, but it hurts real good. To intensify that effect further, you can inch your left arm a little farther out to the right, and inch your right arm, at about a 45-degree angle from your head, farther out to the left. Rest like that for a while, relaxing completely into the position even as you're torqued. Again, the key is to let go into timelessness. Then do the same thing on the other side. If you can do this one while sitting back on your heels, you'll get an even better torque. In this position, it's as if the seed of your heart begins to germinate. Your arms are like fresh green shoots that the heart seed sends out into a new, unknown world. That's going to twist and turn you in ways that at first feel unfamiliar and even uncomfortable, but turn out to stimulate growth. Anytime we point, we're directing the mind in some direction. Now we're pointing in two opposite directions at once. By letting your mind follow and vividly feel the contradictory energetic trajectories of both arms, you're programming mental flexibility, opening neural pathways that allow us to be at home with paradoxes and contradictions. Life requires that. It's messy and multidirectional, and a lot more interesting than the sterile yes or no simplifications that our minds try to impose on it. In The Wizard of Oz, this wonderful flexibility is portrayed by the Scarecrow, who, as played by Ray Bolger, convincingly appears to have no bones. The first time Dorothy meets him, she's at a fork in the yellow brick road, asking, "Now, which way do we go?" He replies, "Of course, people do go both ways," pointing left with his right arm and right with his left, in a gesture that looks a lot like this move. Opening. Now come up to a sitting position. Extend your legs in front of you, then bend your knees toward the ceiling at about a 90-degree angle, with your feet flat on the floor about shoulder-width apart. Leaning back a little, place your palms on the floor about a foot or so behind your hips, depending on your height, with the arms rotated outward so that your fingers point straight back. Now, keeping your palms, bottom, and feet firmly planted, pull against the floor with your feet, as if trying to bring your bottom closer to them. At the same time, close your eyes and arch your back, bringing your shoulders closer together behind you and pushing your chest forward and upward toward the sky at about a 45-degree angle. If you can do so comfortably, let your head drop back. If you experience vertigo or other distress when you drop your head back, don't. In this position, just be. Keep breathing. Feel the arching of your back all along your spine, from your hips to your skull. You'll notice a sort of effervescent tingling in the chest area as the heart center and the emotional energies that are rooted there open up. Let your heart open wide to the sky, to limitless space, to all beings, all of life. This is the opposite of the sheltered, protective feeling of the closed position. So you might think of it as vulnerable, but it feels so delicious and so strong that you know you're okay, boundlessly okay, okay beyond the horizon. You learn deep down into your nervous system that it's safe to open your heart. Stay like this for a little timeless while. Then let the body go soft, allowing your chin to fall toward your chest and your shoulders to collapse toward each other in front of you. If you like, do a few more alternations of arching and collapsing. Some people find this to be the most profound, yet the easiest of the six moves. So, if your time or mobility is limited, you might do just this one. You can also do it first thing in the morning, before getting out of bed, as a wake-up stretch and a way to set a heart-opening tone to your day. Again, never push beyond what's comfortable. And as usual, try things out and see what works for you. Any or all of these moves can be done pretty much anytime, anywhere. You may find them especially helpful before giving your big speech, running your big race, or taking your big exam. Anytime you feel tension or stress in the body, while having a sleepless night or drying out from some substance, these moves can help smooth things out. And as a regular routine, it's great to do them once a day, then go straight into your meditation. The key to these six moves, and to everything actually, is to just be present within them. Don't be going through one move to get it done or get to the next. There is no next. There's never a next. There's only ever here. This. Be here. Rest in this. Chapter 17. Fear versus Love. It's one of those Bible verses that you've probably heard even if you've never touched a Bible or set foot in a church. Perfect love casts out fear. Well now, that's a challenge, an offer we can't refuse, or at least can't ignore. It's such a simple, sweeping claim that we at least have to check it out. And this notion is not confined to the Bible. It's echoed in the insights of psychiatrists like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and David Kessler. There are only two primary emotions, love and fear. We cannot feel these two emotions together at exactly the same time. They're opposites. Even Oprah says it, so it must be true. I believe that every single event in life happens in an opportunity to choose love over fear. Clearly, all these people are talking about something bigger than relational, romantic love, although it certainly might include it. In the Bible verse, the word translated as perfect is, in the original Greek, a form of teleos, which means something completed, fully expanded, as in the pirate's telescope, which shares the same root. Love is expansive. Fear is contractive. As every single event in life comes along, spectacular sunset over the Rockies, oblivious guy shouting into his phone on the morning commuter train, we can contract to reject it or expand to embrace it. Love less and fear more, or love more and fear less. The question is, how? Is there actually a way to choose the expansiveness of love over the contractions of fear when fear is a deeply ingrained habit? As we've said before, fear can rule the mundane, everyday moments of our lives, so that we can find it too anxiety-provoking to eat dinner alone in a restaurant, or to insist that an ornery customer service rep treat us right. And fear can rule the big moments, when you've just gotten the diagnosis and the adrenaline and terror set in. The ground drops out from under you, the room spins, your heart pounds, your mouth goes dry. Then this love business can sound like just a fluffy, pretty idea, no matter what Oprah says. Well, it takes some practice, but it can be done. Some very skillful methods have come down through the centuries. One is supposed to have been taught by the Buddha himself, who was forced by circumstances to do deep research into the subject in his early years of solitary meditation in the forests of northern India. People often enjoy the fantasy of escaping the stresses of everyday life to meditate blissfully in some cheerful storybook forest, with a few friendly Disney woodland creatures curled at their feet. But if you've ever sat alone with your eyes closed in a real forest, you know that every thud or creak is a potential bear or wildcat, and the snakes arrive unannounced. Once, 20 years ago, when I was on a solo retreat in upstate New York, a snake glided over the instep of my bare right foot. I can still feel it. Later in the Buddha's life, he is said to have taught the fear antidote that had worked for him, calling it metta bhavana, loving-kindness meditation. To practice metta meditation for the first time, it's best to do it when things are relatively calm rather than on red alert. Again, do the fire drill before the fire. Sit comfortably with your eyes closed for a little while. Perhaps things settle down a bit on their own. Then think, may I be happy? May I be peaceful? May I be free from suffering. May I live with ease. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be free from suffering. May you live with ease. May all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings live with ease. Think this, or if you prefer, softly speak it, in a deliberate, unhurried way, pausing after each sentence to let it sink in, to be felt. Be present with each sentence as if there's no next sentence or next anything to go on to. Don't try to manufacture some artificial, loving mood, but, in a natural, straightforward way, be open to the sometimes heartbreaking aspiration of all beings, as they strive to be happy and not to suffer. That's all they want, just like you. Who does the word you in the second stanza refer to? Fill in the blank, whoever you choose, or whoever or whatever shows up in your thoughts. If you're meditating in the forest, it could be the bear, or snake, or whatever unidentified creature just snapped that twig. At home, it could be your child, or boss, or partner. If you do this practice in a relaxed, easygoing way, you may be surprised at who makes the next appearance. Perhaps your unfavorite political figure, or the guy who stole your parking spot this morning, or your daughter's doofus boyfriend. If you've had a difficult romantic breakup, or a loved one has died, or someone has become the perennial turd in the punch bowl of your life, then make them the you. You'll find some powerful healing here. Don't try to feel loving, and don't worry about what you do feel. Just think the words, let go into the practice, and the results will sneak up on you in their own way and their own time. The one rule is, whoever appears, no matter what they're like or what they've done, we bless them with the wish for happiness, peace, freedom, and ease. On the way to perfect love, we can't leave anyone out. In this era, when seriously depraved people in positions of great power indulge in truly repugnant behavior, that's not always easy. But blessing people is not the same as endorsing their conduct. As soon as you open your eyes, you can go back to calling them out for their crimes. You can go back to loathing them, if you feel like it. You may not. For what it's worth, you may start to see that if we could really give them peace and happiness, they wouldn't act the way they do. I and I. How does this practice work to break down fear? There are a few levels to it. First, it subtly introduces a revolutionary definition of love, the wish for the happiness of the innumerable beings in the universe, of which we ourselves are one, but only one. This immediately shifts things away from the conventional, usually unexamined, desire-based, romantic definition, reinforced by pop song lyrics from Elvis, I want you, I need you, I love you, to Rihanna, I'm no good without you, and I can't get enough. By this definition, metta really can generate love, and as Kubler-Ross and Kessler point out, you can't love and fear at the same time because they're opposite emotions. But there's also a deeper, more fundamental truth that starts to open to us. As the contemporary British sage Rupert Spira puts it, love is not a feeling. It's lack of an other, of otherness. Fear depends on a sense of otherness, separateness between the you that appears to threaten me and the I that feels threatened. As soon as I start wishing you happiness, I'm warming up and softening that sense of separation. We've experienced those softer boundaries with the loved ones of our own family. They're actually not entirely separate from us, but flesh of our flesh, even when they're infuriating. So we feel at home wishing for their happiness. Certainly we may go through days or weeks without acknowledging how deeply we love our loved ones and how earnestly we want them to be happy. That which is most intimate and most dear can most easily be taken for granted. Nothing is more intimate or dear to us than our own breath. But we don't think about it till something threatens to stop it. So, metta is, among other things, an opportunity to acknowledge this love deeply, inwardly, even when acknowledging it aloud might be awkward. And now we are, in a way, enlarging our family, finding that same intimate connection with strangers and even with enemies as we have with our loved ones. Outwardly, of course. If you're the boss and you're unjustly raking me over the coals, or if you're the bear and you're trashing my campsite, I still have to do what I common sensibly have to do. But I can also sit down in the morning or evening and inwardly find our deep connectedness, and that will blunt my fear of you. You and I are seeking exactly the same peace and ease, even if the paths of our seeking collide. In that sense, you and I are family, and the more clearly I experience that, the less I fear you. Our quarrels are all in the family. Our relationship starts to shift from I and you to I, as the Jamaicans say. True non-otherness means there's only one of us here, taking a two-ish shape. We've been grappling with each other like two wrestling octopuses. But now, as we get our tentacles untangled, we discover that we're really just one big octopus with two heads. Why would I and I fight with myself? The point of all meditative methods is the effects that carry over into day-to-day life. If I can really grow in this sense of non-otherness, then, even as I defend myself from the boss or back away from the bear, acting as the situation demands, I can do it while fearing less, and my freedom from panic will make me more adept at handling the danger with grace and skill. I can relax at the moment of contact. That also means I can be more skillful in helping others. Social activists sometimes worry that meditative practice might be a kind of tranquilizer that makes people apathetic about the plight of the world, but it doesn't work that way. If we think of the activists who have really made the world better, Gandhi, Mandela, Dr. King, it's clear that the great power of their actions, even in the face of almost insurmountable opposition, has come from a place of peace, not stress. A few years ago, I attended a celebration of the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday, and to me, the most striking thing he said was, "If you pray for the benefit of all sentient beings with sincerity, then, when an opportunity presents itself, you must act." So, love casts out fear. The same analysis applies to anxiety and anger. In fact, some preliminary studies indicate that metapractice may measurably improve symptoms of anger, anxiety, depression, and even stress-related inflammation. These findings would not have surprised the Buddha. In touting the benefits of metapractice, he said, "One sleeps easily, wakes easily, dreams no evil dreams. One is dear to human beings, dear to non-human beings. One's mind gains concentration quickly. One's complexion is bright." If the idea of a meditative practice making your complexion brighter seems far-fetched, think of the times you've seen a friend and said, "Wow, you're glowing," and they replied, "Well, I'm in love." That glow, indicating improved blood flow to the skin, is just the most immediately visible symptom of physical well-being associated with being in love. Other symptoms, studies have shown, include lower blood pressure and lower levels of the stress hormone cortisol. There have even been some indications of improved cancer recovery. A key symptom is higher levels of oxytocin, the mellow, relaxing trust hormone that is produced during childbirth and breastfeeding, the activities of intimate, mother glow, flesh of my flesh connectedness. Sex can stimulate oxytocin production as well, which is why, when all goes well, sex is accurately called making love. The Buddha's point about improved concentration also makes sense. Focusing on the task at hand becomes easy and natural when, instead of being distracted by doubts and anxieties, we're performing the task from a place of quietly glowing intimacy, even when the task is trigonometry homework. When we say, "I'm in love," please note the word "in." What if, even without another person necessarily being involved, we could be in love, like being in a warm bath? I've seen good actors do this on cue, with the same unmistakable hormonal glow. Through practices such as metta, we're soaking, marinating in love. And if we soak deep enough, we're going to stay damp when we come out. Then others, even subliminally, will pick up the signal and start to soften toward us, whether it's the boss or the bear, dear to human beings, dear to non-human beings. That makes our immediate environment a friendlier place to live in, where there's objectively less for us to fear, as the Buddha learned in the forest. One Lama I studied with, when asked what the benefit of meditation is, replied, "Other people become so much nicer." Also, notice the psychological shrewdness of the way metta practice is structured. Few of us are saintly enough to devote ourselves to others' happiness if ours is in doubt. So the technique starts with the wish for our own happiness and expands outward from there. As Albert Einstein wrote, "A human being is part of the whole called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty." The third stanza of this metta practice is a staging area where we can start to do just that, embrace all beings. As our circle of compassion grows bigger, our own problems take up a smaller part of the stage. Paradoxically, we're the one who benefits. The way to liberate oneself from Einstein's prison, the optical illusion of separation, is through selflessness. We can only be wrapped up in, "I'm scared," or "I'm furious," or "I need a drink," to the extent that we're wrapped up in "I." The word "escape" is derived from the Latin "ex capare," meaning to slip out of your cape. Think of the separate, personal "I" as a cape we've been wrapped in, one with a lot of static cling that's always collecting bits of lint and fuzz. We can try to keep picking it off, one bit at a time, an endless task. But if we can manage to slip out of the cape, we're all done. Chapter 18. Cold, cold water. There's another procedure you can add to your morning routine that will help start each day fresh, free from old patterns of fear, anger, or anything else that constricts your consciousness. It's quick, simple, and convenient. It would be nice if it were also pleasurable and inviting, like the soaking in a warm tub ease of meditation, but it's virtually the opposite. It's simply this: every morning, douse yourself with cold water. I know, and I'm sorry, but believe it or not, you're going to love this, even if you hate it. And even if, especially if, you hate the cold, like me. My wife's always opening windows. I'm always closing them. She turns the thermostat down, and when she's not looking, I turn it back up. You don't have to jump into an icy lake or even take an entire cold shower. You can enjoy your usual warm shower and then, for a cool rinse-off, nudge the knob from H to C. Or at least close enough to C to put you well into your discomfort zone. As the water turns cold, you can start with it streaming onto the top of your head, where you'll feel it the least, then ease the rest of your body into it. After all of our emphasis on easy, comfortable meditation, it may seem surprising that now we're suggesting something so harsh. But this works because it's harsh, because you'd always rather not, because you think you can't do it, because when you do it, you feel like you're going to die. But you do it anyway, and you don't die. That starts the day with a powerful message, delivered directly and physically to your whole body, deeper than the pep talks you give your mind or emotions. You may receive other shocks today that you'll think will kill you, but they won't. You may face other challenges today that you'll think you can't handle, but you can. You've started the day by rising above. Because it didn't kill you, it made you stronger. And at some point, you may notice that this practice reveals a form of survival more profound than the physical. Despite the intensity of the shock, it's just another passing experience, another phenomenon of which we're aware. The experiencer, silent, perfect, non-phenomenal awareness, persists, ever the same, before, during, and after this shock or any shock the world may offer, no matter how intense. The Gospel's, "Be of good cheer, I have overcome the world," becomes more than just an inspiring declaration. It's a matter-of-fact report on our own status. In addition to jump-starting your morning on a note of fearlessness, this energizing jolt to the body also serves as a sort of palate cleanser for the mind and emotions, so they can encounter things afresh. If you've been dwelling on some sticky problem or wallowing in some tired emotional pattern, whether compulsively in the back of your mind or vividly up front, this bracing dose of cold water cuts through all that. It's a benign form of do-it-yourself shock therapy. When that water hits your chest, you can't think or feel much of anything except, "Ah!" So, at least for that moment, you've dropped the old stuff, the habitual concepts and neuroses. You've interrupted their momentum, so they can't continue unless you pick them up again. You probably will pick them up again, but every time you drop them, through meditation, cold shower therapy, smacking your hands together, or anything else, you weaken their hold a little. Eventually you ask yourself, "Why do I keep picking these up?" And you stop. Among apes and proto-humans, we can assume that only a privileged few had access to hot springs. Most had just cold surf or streams or waterfalls. Cold water is what our bodies are evolved to bathe in, and it makes sense that there's a biological rightness to it, with measurable benefits. Studies have shown that cold showers reduce depression, not surprising for a form of shock therapy. In fact, if you're depressive, another tip is to keep a stiff brush in the shower and give your skin a good scrubbing every morning. The nature of depression is to withdraw from the senses, and vigorous stimulation helps to bring you to your senses, literally. Other studies have shown that cold showering even promotes weight loss through the production of brown fat, a beneficial, non-accumulating type of fat that babies have in abundance and that acts as a kind of metabolic furnace, burning up the white fat that otherwise makes people overweight. As the cold water pours down, feel free to imagine that your accumulated traumas, fears, and stubborn habits are somehow bound up in your congealed white fat. And now you're stimulating your metabolism to burn it all away. I suspect that one day science will discover some truth to this. When you douse yourself in cold water, you're also participating in a grand awakening tradition that cuts across cultures and eras. For thousands of years, Hindus have bathed in the Ganges. Every morning they walk down the ghats, stair-like stone embankments, on the western shore of the river to do their physical and spiritual cleansing. One of my most indelible memories is of sitting in a little rowboat at the ghats of Varanasi, considered India's holiest city, at sunrise. It's stirring to see thousands of people crowding to the water's edge, the men in bathing suits or white cotton dhotis, the women in colorful saris, some dunking themselves, some scrubbing up with soap, some washing their kids. As the sun rises over the sandbanks on the opposite shore, many people chant the Gayatri Mantra, the ancient invocation to the dawning of the new day and the dawning of enlightenment. Jesus's awakening seems to have taken place when he was baptized by John in the cold waters of the River Jordan, where the Holy Spirit descended upon him like a dove. The dove is the symbol of peace, and the more you sit and abide in the utterly silent, utterly peaceful nature of your own essence, baptizing yourself in it every day, the more you'll recognize this story as a description of your own awakening, not just a remote tale about events that happened 2,000 years ago. John had been telling everyone that the kingdom of God was at hand, but Jesus, like you, saw that it was even closer than that. It's within you. Chapter 19. In Your Eyes. In Chapter 17, we introduced meta-meditation as a way of softening up the apparent boundaries between ourselves and others, of casting out fear by being in love, soaking in the warm tub of non-separateness. That awakening into love is such an important part of our project that it's useful to have more than one method for doing it. So here's another one. You may have had the good fortune to be around someone who, one way or another, has soaked deep enough in the tub of love that they're sopping wet all the time. Someone who radiates the glow of love so brilliantly that it illuminates the place of connectedness for others in a way that's hard to miss. I've seen the Dalai Lama fill whole stadiums with that glow. In particular, that glow can show in the eyes. Again, the eyes are the windows to the soul. And some eyes seem like crystal clear, unobstructed windows to crystal clear, unobstructed souls. These are eyes that are free of worry, judgment, expectation, need, fear. They look at you from a place that is bottomless and bottomlessly accepting and loving. They may be the eyes of someone who's widely regarded as an awakened sage, or the eyes of your nana, or your kindergarten teacher, or your electrician. In India, being in the presence of such a one, seeing and being seen by such eyes, is called darshan, vision. And people traditionally have gone on long, arduous journeys just to experience the darshan of some great sage. Sometimes even a painting or statue or photograph of such an awakened being can capture and transmit that spark. Please sit down with a picture of someone who, for you, seems to have the eyes of non-otherness, the eyes of awakened love. Whether it's the Dalai Lama, the Blessed Virgin, Jesus, Ananda Maima, Einstein, the Buddha, Mr. Rogers, or whoever does it for you. On the Fearless page of my website, there are two pictures you can use if you like. One is a photo that has deeply inspired many people, of the great 20th century Indian sage Sri Ramana Maharshi. The other is a painting of the martyred 7th century Irish maiden Saint Dimphna. According to legend, after her mother died, her father lost his mind, tried to force Dimphna to marry him, and killed her when she refused. She's the patron saint of those who suffer from mental illness or nervous disorders, and she's supposed to have helped many agitated people find peace. The fact that historically she may never have existed is, of course, completely unimportant. What's important about these pictures is what you find in them, or rather, through them. They're windows, not just to a soul, but to the soul, the non-separate beingness we all share. Just sit quietly, look into those eyes, and let them look into you, all the way in. That's all. Relax and take time to let whatever happens happen. Sometimes, for some people, that may be all the meditation you need. Seeing with the eyes of love. But there's an additional phase of this practice that you can also do. Again, gaze at the picture for a while and let it gaze into you. Then close your eyes and imagine yourself behind those infinitely peaceful, accepting, affirming eyes that you've been looking into, but now looking out at the world through them. In your imagination, take a walk wearing those eyes. Stroll through your neighborhood or town. See the buildings and trees and animals and people, all so beautiful and lovable just as they are, and they don't even know it. And then turn the next corner and see you, standing or sitting there, perhaps dealing with whatever situation has been stirring up your anxiety or anger or fear. With the natural, unwavering equanimity of those sages' eyes, see that situation, including any people who may be involved. Oh, look, there's you and the project you've been so nervous about tackling. Or, oh, look, there's you and the substance you're trying to quit. Or, oh, look, there's you and your ex and her lawyer. Or, oh, look, there's you and the parent or the sibling or the alienated friend you're trying to get things right with or have given up on getting things right with. All those beings, all equally your beloved children, flesh of your flesh, just trying to be happy and not suffer, trying so hard. Just see them. Someday you'll have eyes of your own like this, but meanwhile, this kind of little stroll with borrowed sage's eyes can help you pick up some taste of what it's like, and then recognize your own flashes of genuine love-permeated seeing, darshan, when they come along. And they will. Recently, at one of our Tuesday evening meditation sessions, a woman told a story about being in a business meeting and finding herself thinking harsh, judgmental thoughts about the other participants. But then, she said, I realized I could drop my judging thoughts, and as soon as I did, I suddenly realized that I loved them all. That's only natural. As Marianne Williamson put it, love is what we were born with. Fear is what we learned here. Love is not some attitude or mood that we have to construct. It's what's left when we deconstruct our artificial sense of separation, when we clean the dust from our eyes and recognize our long-lost brothers and sisters, our long-lost prodigal sons and daughters, all our long-lost lovers. Chapter 20. Sit down, stand up. My late first wife, Maggie O'Brien, was a successful fashion model before we were married. Certainly she was beautiful, but more strikingly, she was glamorous, which has more to do with attitude than cheekbones. It's a relaxed, elegant, and above all, confident way of presenting oneself. One day I asked her about it. I had thought of it as a rare commodity, but she laughed and let me in on her secret. Anyone can be glamorous, she said. All it takes is great posture and a great haircut. I can't help you with the haircut, but let's talk about posture. Posture, the way we hold our bodies, both reflects and is reflected by how we hold ourselves as persons in the world. It can promote either greater ease and confidence or greater constriction and timidity. Once more, the clues are there in our language, when we tell someone to stand up for yourself, or when we call him a stand-up guy, or when we tell the truth straight up, or when the Bible says Job was an upright man. No matter what you've been through, no matter what you're facing, even if you feel depressed or defeated, you can start to break out of it simply by standing and sitting up straight. Can it really be that simple? Psychologists have done some compelling research on this point. In one experiment, they had subjects answer stress-inducing job interview questions, then complete questionnaires designed to reveal their emotional state. At the outset, half the subjects were told to slouch and half were told to sit upright. That's all. The slouchers scored significantly higher on the fear scale. Those sitting up straight scored higher on the self-esteem scale, and their responses to the interview questions used much more positive language. In another study, this time with people who were clinically depressed, again each subject was told to either slouch or sit upright. Then they were presented with a list of words, some negative, some positive. When later asked to recall as many of the words as they could, the upright sitters remembered positive and negative words in equal proportion. the slouchers remembered more of the negative words. The implications here are stunning. Our entire picture of life is drawn from what we remember, all the history that we drag behind us and on which we model our hopes and fears for the future. And it might all be colored by as simple and dumb an element as how we were sitting when we formed those memories. Again, the clue is in our language. We don't just have memories, we form them. And apparently, through the mind-body connection, the form we give them can echo the form of our body. Through the distorting lens of bent posture, we create a distorted, bent version of reality, tainting it with what's called negative recall bias. Fortunately, all the psychologists had to do to elicit the opposite effect was to tell people to sit up straight. But sometimes, as a teacher of mine used to say, it's simple, but it's not easy. For one thing, unlike the upright Job, we live in an age of smartphones. A number of clinicians have studied their effect on posture, including the New Zealand physiotherapist Steve August, who has coined a term, the eye hunch, a.k.a. tech neck. People typically browse, text, and tweet with their heads at a 60-degree angle, which adds the equivalent of about 50 pounds of dead weight stressing the neck and upper back. One result is that dowager's hump, the stooped, forward curve of the upper back often seen on elderly women, is now becoming epidemic among teenagers. And Brazilian researchers have found that this same posture correlates strongly with depression. In one cleverly designed study, Professor Amy Cuddy and her associates at Harvard Business School sat each subject down alone with either a desktop computer, a laptop computer, a tablet computer, or a smartphone. Each subject was told to use the device for 5 minutes. When the time was up, instead of telling the subjects they could leave, the researchers left them doing nothing and waited to see how long they would twiddle their thumbs before taking the initiative and asking permission to go. The researchers found that the smaller the device, and correspondingly the more severe the eye hunch, the longer it took for the subjects to assert themselves. Shrink your body, and you shrink your spirit. Sit too long with the eye hunch, and you have, as it were, less backbone. For Professor Cuddy, there's a very practical takeaway. Keep your head up and your shoulders back when looking at your phone, even if that means holding it at eye level. You can also try stretching and massaging the two muscle groups that are involved in the eye hunch, those between the shoulder blades and the ones along the sides of the neck. This helps reduce scarring and restores elasticity. But there's a second element that, again, can make this simple prescription not so easy to follow. For many of us, being told to keep our head up and shoulders back summons painful childhood flashbacks of some severe authority figure, perhaps a parent or gym teacher, who chastised and reprimanded us till good posture became a symbol of defeat rather than boldness. One friend tells me that someday she'll write a memoir about her relationship with her overcritical grandmother, titled, "I Stand Corrected." The problem, of course, is that the impulse to straighten was imposed from the outside rather than arising naturally from within. This closely echoes what we've learned about meditation. Trying to force the body to be straight is a lot like trying to force the mind to be peaceful. So, here's a natural inner-to-outer approach to posture. If possible, do this barefoot on the grass or ground. Stand with your feet a comfortable distance apart, about shoulder width, and close your eyes. Now, feel the earth through the soles of your feet. It's always there, even when your shoes or 50 floors of office building intervene. Taking plenty of time, feel the gravitational connection between you and the earth. Feel how the earth holds you and how its gravity reaches up through the soles of your feet. through your calves and shins, through your knees, thighs, hips, through your lower torso, through your upper torso, through your neck, and all the way up to the top of your head.